my mole deep in the department. The body will be found. Swanger will be caught and put on trial, and I will be nowhere near the courthouse. If he killed the girl, I want him locked up. I kick around several other scenarios, and things get foggier, not clearer. At 5:30, I put on the coffee. While it brews, I rack all 15 balls and break with a rather soft shot. The neighbor next door has complained about the noise of clacking balls at weird hours, so I work on my finesse game. I run the table, sink the 8-ball in a corner, pour a cup of strong coffee, and run the table again. Another rack, and I leave the 4-ball an inch from the pocket. 33 in a row. Not bad. Vasectomy reversals? Chapter 12. The police follow me, but half-heartedly. Partner says they're tailing me about half the time, that they got fired up when Swanger met me in the van, but that was over a week ago. Partner drops me off at Ken's Cars, a cheap second-hand lot in the Hispanic part of town. I've done some work for Ken, kept him out of jail, and he and I both know that our tag-teaming days are not over. He loves shady deals. The darker, the better. And it's just a matter of time before a SWAT team shows up with another arrest warrant. For $20 cash per day, Ken will lease me a serviceable car from his SAD inventory, no questions asked. I do this occasionally when I think I'm being watched. My black Ford cargo van is quite easy to spot. The dented Subaru wagon Ken has selected for me, however, will never attract attention. I spend a few minutes with him, swap some insults, and hit the road. I weave through a run-down part of town, circling back here and there, with one eye on the mirror. I eventually find a bypass that takes me to the interstate, and when I'm sure there's no one following me, I head south. 52 miles from the city limits, I pass Dr. Wu's sign on the other side of the road. As Swanger said, it's a large billboard at the edge of a cornfield. Next to the words, "Vasectomy Reversals," is the large, goofy face of Dr. Wu as he looks down upon the northbound traffic. I turn around at the next exit, drive 4 miles back to the sign, and park near it. Traffic roars by, the drafts from the big trucks almost lifting my little Subaru. Next to the shoulder there is a ditch covered with weeds and clogged with litter. And beyond the ditch there is a chain-link fence choked with vines. Beyond the fence is a gravel frontage road that borders the cornfield. The farmer who owns the place has carved out a narrow rectangle to lease to the sign company, and in the center of it there are 4 large metal poles that anchor the billboard. Around them are weeds, more litter, a few stray stalks of corn. Above them, Dr. Wu grins at the traffic as he hawks his skills. He's the last guy I would trust with my testicles. Though I have no experience, I suppose one could use darkness as cover, ease along the frontage road, dig a nice grave, drag a body over to it, refill the hole, scatter dirt and litter around, and cover it all up. Let a few months go by as the seasons change and the dirt settles. And why would you pick a spot so close to an interstate highway with 20,000 cars a day? I have no idea, but I remind myself that I'm trying to understand the mind of a very sick person. Hiding in the open works all the time, I guess. And I'm sure that at 3 a.m., this place is fairly deserted. I stare at the weeds under the sign and think about the Kemp family. And I curse the day I met Arch Swanger. Chapter 13. 2 days later, I'm waiting in a hallway in the old courthouse when I get a text from Detective Reardon. He says we need to talk, and soon. It's urgent. An hour later, Partner drops me off at Central, and I hustle back to Reardon's cramped and suffocating office. No hellos, no handshake, no greeting of any kind. But then I don't expect any. He grunts.
You got a minute?
I'm here, I say.
Have a seat.
There is only one place to sit, a leather bench covered with dust and files. I look at it and say, "That's okay, I'll just stand."
Whatever. Do you know where Swanger is?
No, I have no idea. Thought you guys were bird-dogging him.
We were, but he got away. No sign for over a week. Nothing. Vanished.
He falls into his wooden swivel chair and eventually gets both feet onto his desk.
Are you still his lawyer?
No. When he hired me, he paid with a rubber check. Our contract is void. A smirk, a fake smile.
Well, he thinks otherwise. This came in just after midnight, right here on my office phone.
He reaches over and hits two buttons on his vintage answering machine. After the beep, Arch's voice begins.
This message is for Detective Landy Reardon. This is Arch Swanger calling. I'm on the road and I'm not coming back. You guys have hounded me for months and I'm tired of it. My poor mother is out of her mind because of your constant surveillance and abusive tactics. Please leave her alone. She's completely innocent, and so am I. You know damned well I didn't kill that girl, had nothing to do with it. I'd like to explain this to someone who's willing to listen, but if I come back, you'll just bust my ass and throw me in jail. I got some good information, Reardon, and I'd like to talk to someone. I know where she is right now. How about that?
There is a long pause. I look at Reardon, and he says,
Hang on.
Arch coughs a couple of times, and when he resumes, his voice is shaky, as though he's getting emotional.
Only three people know where she's buried, Reardon. Only three. Me, the guy who killed her, and my lawyer, Sebastian Rudd. I told Rudd because as a lawyer he can't tell anyone. Isn't that screwed up, Reardon? Why should a lawyer be able to keep such deadly secrets? I like Rudd, don't get me wrong. Hell, I hired him. And if by some lucky break you're able to find me, then I'll bring in Rudd to walk me.
Another pause, then,
Gotta go, Reardon. Later.
I step over to the leather bench and sit on some files. Reardon turns off the answering machine and leans forward on his elbows.
It came in from a prepaid cell phone, and we couldn't track it. We have no idea where he is.
I take a deep breath as I try to unscramble my thoughts. There is no strategic or common-sense reason for Swanger to tell the police that I know where the body is buried. Period. And the fact that he was so eager to tell me and then blab it to the cops makes me doubt him even more. He's a con, perhaps a serial killer, a psychopath who enjoys playing games and revels in the lying. But whatever he is, and whatever his motives, he has thrown me off a cliff, and I'm free-falling. The door suddenly opens, and in walks Roy Kemp, assistant chief of police and father of the missing girl. He closes the door behind him and takes a step toward me. He's a tough guy, an ex-marine with a square jaw and a grayish crew cut. His eyes are weary and red, evidence of the toll the last year has taken. His eyes also convey a hatred that makes my skin crawl. My collar is instantly wet. Reardon gets to his feet, cracks his knuckles as if he's about to use his fists, and gives me a look that could kill, and probably will. It's fatal to show weakness to a cop, or a prosecutor or judge, even a jury. But right now, it is impossible to conjure up the slightest trace of confidence, let alone my usual cockiness. Kemp gets right to the point with,
Where is she, Rudd?
I slowly get to my feet, raise both hands, and say,
I gotta think about this, okay? I'm caught off guard here. You guys had time to plan this ambush. Give me some time, okay?
Kemp says,
I don't give a damn about your confidentiality and ethics and all that crap, Rudd. You have no idea what we're going through. It's been 11 months and 18 days of sheer hell. My wife can't get out of bed. My whole family is falling apart. We're desperate, Rudd.
For all of his fearsomeness, Roy Kemp is a man in grievous pain, a father who's sleepwalking through his worst nightmare. He needs a body, a funeral, a permanent grave where he and his wife can kneel on the grass and properly mourn. The horror and uncertainty must be overwhelming. He's blocking my narrow path to the door, and I'm wondering if he'll actually get physical. I say, "Look, Chief, you're assuming that everything Arch Swanger says is the truth, and that could be a bad assumption. Do you know where my daughter is?" "I know what Arch Swanger said, but I do not know if he's telling the truth. Frankly, I doubt it."
"Then tell us anyway. We'll go look."
"It's not that simple. I can't repeat what he said to me in confidence. You know that." Kemp closes his eyes. I glance down and notice both his fists are clenched. Slowly, he relaxes them. I look at Reardon, who's glaring at me. I look back at Kemp, whose red eyes are open slightly. He's nodding as if he's saying, "Okay, Rudd, we'll play it your way. But we'll get you." Frankly, I'm on their side. I would love to spill my guts, help get the girl properly laid to rest, help track down Swanger, and watch with satisfaction as the jury nails him for murder. Sadly, though, that is not an option. I take a small step toward the door and say, "I'd like to leave now." Kemp doesn't move, and somehow I manage to brush by him without provoking a fight. As I grab the doorknob, I can almost feel a knife in my back. But I survive and make it to the hallway. I've never left Central in a bigger hurry. Chapter 14. It's the third Friday of the month, time to see Judith for our mandatory two-drink meeting. Neither of us wants it, but neither is willing to surrender and quit. To do so would be to confess a weakness, something we both simply cannot do, not to each other anyway. We tell ourselves that we need to keep the lines of communication open because we share a son. That poor child. This is our first drink since she dragged me into court in her futile effort to terminate all visitation rights. So, with that little brawl still hanging in the air, there will be an even thicker layer of tension. Frankly, I was hoping she would cancel. I could easily be provoked into a tongue-lashing. I get to the bar early and find a booth. She arrives on time, as always, but with a pleasant look on her face. Judith is not a pleasant person and doesn't smile much. Most lawyers battle stress, but most lawyers don't work in a firm with 9 other women, all known to be ball-squeezing litigators looking for a fight. Her office is a pressure cooker, and I suspect her home life is not that much fun. The older Starcher gets, the more he talks about all the yelling between Judith and Ava. I, of course, pump the kid for all the dirt I can get. "How was your week?" I ask, the standard opening.
"The same. Looks like you're on a roll. Another picture in the paper."
The waiter takes our orders, always the same. Chardonnay for her, whiskey sour for me. Whatever pleasant thought she brought into the bar has now vanished. "A bit premature," I say. "I don't represent the guy anymore. He couldn't handle the fee."
"Gee, think of all the publicity you'll miss."
"I'll find some more."
"I have no doubt about that."
I'm not in the mood to swap insults. I get Starcher tomorrow for my 36 hours. Any problems with that?
"What are your plans?"
"So I have to submit my plans to you for approval?
When did the court order this?"
"Just curious, that's all."
"You need a drink."
We stare at the table for a few minutes, waiting for the alcohol. When it arrives, we grab the glasses. After the third gulp, I say, "My mother is in town. We'll take Starcher to the mall for the usual ritual whereby the non-custodial parent kills a few hours drinking coffee while the kid rides the carousel and bangs around the playground. Then we'll have bad pizza and bad ice cream in the food court and watch the clowns turn flips and pass out balloons. After that, we'll drive down to the river and take a walk by the boats in the harbor. What else would you like to know?"
"You plan to keep him tomorrow night?"
"I get 36 hours once a month. That's 9 a.m. tomorrow until 9 p.m. Sunday. Do the math. It's not that complicated." The waiter pops in to ask how we're doing. I order another round, even though our glasses are not yet half empty. Over the past year, I have almost managed to look forward to these brief meetings with Judith. We're both lawyers, and occasionally we've found common ground. I once loved her, though I'm not so sure she felt the same. We share a child. I have entertained the fantasy that we could possibly develop a friendship, one that I need because I have so few friends. Right now, though, I can't stand the sight of her. We drink in silence, two brooding ex-lovers who would really like to strangle one another. She breaks the tension with, "What kind of person is Arch Swanger?" We talk about him for a few minutes, then about the abduction and the nightmare the Kemp family is enduring. A lawyer she knows once handled a DUI for Gilliana's last boyfriend, which is supposed to somehow be enlightening. The drinks are finished in 30 minutes, a record, and we part ways without even the obligatory peck on the cheek. Chapter 15. It's a challenge each month to plan an activity that keeps Starcher entertained. He's already told me he's tired of the mall, the zoo, the fire station, miniature golf, and the children's theater. What he really wants to do is watch more cage fighting, but that's not going to happen. So I buy him a boat. We meet my mother at a place called The Landing, a contrived boathouse in the middle of City Park. She and I drink coffee while Starcher slurps his hot cocoa. My mother is worried about his upbringing. The kid has no table manners and never utters the word sir, ma'am, please, and thank you. I've pushed him on this and gotten nowhere. The boat is a remote-controlled model racer with an engine that whines like a muffled chainsaw. The pond is a large man-made circle of water with a gushing fountain in the center. It's a magnet for model boats of all varieties, and for all ages. Starcher and I fiddle with the remote controls for half an hour before everything makes sense. When he's comfortable, I turn him loose and take a seat next to my mother on a bench under a tree. It's a beautiful day, with crisp, light air and a brilliant blue sky. The park is crawling with people, families strolling about eating ice cream, new moms with massive strollers, young lovers rolling in the leaves, and no shortage of divorced fathers exercising their rights of visitation. My mother and I chat about nothing of any importance as we watch her only grandson in the distance. She lives 2 hours away and does not get our local news. She's heard nothing of the Swanger affair, and I'm not about to bring it up. She has a lot of opinions and does not approve my career. Her first husband, my father, was a lawyer who made a nice living in real estate. He died when I was 10. Her second husband made a fortune in rubber bullets and died at the age of 62. She's been afraid to gamble on a third one. I fetch us more coffee and paper cups, and we resume our conversation. Starcher waves me over, and when I get there, he hands me the controls and says he needs to go pee. The restroom is not far away, just on the other side of the pond in a building that houses the concession stands and park offices. I ask him if he needs help, and he shoots me a dirty look. He is, after all, now 8 years old, and gaining confidence. I watch him as he walks to the building and enters the men's restroom. I stop the boat and wait. There is a sudden commotion behind me, loud, angry voices, then two gunshots crack through the air. People start screaming. About 50 yards away, a black teenager sprints across the park, leaps over a bench, darts between some saplings and into the woods, running as if his life is in danger. Evidently it is. Not far behind him is another young black male, angrier and with the gun. He fires it again, and people hit the ground. All around me, folks who were enjoying the day are now ducking, crawling, clutching children, and scurrying for their lives. It's a scene from television, something we've all witnessed before, and it takes a few seconds to realize that this is not fiction. That's a real gun. I think about Starcher, but he's on the other side of the pond in the restroom, a good distance from the gunfire. As I duck and look wildly around, a man scampering away bumps into me, grunts, "Sorry," and keeps moving. When both the prey and the hunter are lost in the woods, I wait, afraid to move. Then, two more gunshots in the distance. If the second guy found the first guy, at least we didn't have to watch it. We pause, wait, then start to move again. My heart is racing as I stand and gawk at the thick trees along with everyone else. When it appears as though the danger has passed, I take a deep breath. People stare at each other, relieved but still stunned. Did we really just see what we just saw? Two policemen on bicycles fly around the corner and disappear into the woods. In the distance, a siren can be heard. I look at my mother, who's on the phone as if she missed it all. I look at the men's restroom. Starcher is still inside. I start walking that way, pausing to place the remote control on the bench beside my mother. Several men and boys have come and gone from the restroom.
"What was that?" she asks.
"Life in the big city," I say as I walk away. Starcher is not in the restroom. I hurry outside and begin looking around. I grab my mother, tell her he's disappeared, and tell her to check out the ladies' restroom. For several long minutes, the two of us scour the area, our fear mounting with each second. He's not the kind of kid who would wander off. No, Starcher would take a pee and head straight back to the pond to continue his boat racing. My heart is pounding, and I'm sweating. The two bicycle cops emerge from the woods without a suspect and head our way. I stop them, tell them my son is missing, and they immediately get on the radio. In my panic, I stop others and ask them to help. Two more bicycle cops arrive. The area around the landing is now a panic zone. Everyone knows a kid is missing. The police are trying to lock down the entire park to keep anyone from leaving, but there are a dozen points of entry and exit. Patrol cars arrive. The urgent wail of sirens only adds to the alarm. I see a man in a red sweater. I think I saw him enter the men's restroom. He says yes, he was there, and he saw a kid at the urinal. Everything seemed fine. No, he did not see the kid leave. I jog up and down the sidewalks that weave through the park, asking everyone along the way if they've seen an 8-year-old boy who seemed lost. He was wearing jeans and a brown sweatshirt. No one has seen him. As the seconds tick by, I try to calm myself. He has just wandered off. He has not been abducted. It doesn't work. I am in full panic. This is the awful story you read about but think it can never happen to you. Chapter 16. After half an hour, my mother is ready to collapse. A medic sits beside her on a park bench and tends to her. The police ask me to stay with her too, but I cannot sit still. There are cops everywhere. God bless them. A young man in a dark suit introduces himself as Lynn Colfax. He is the detective in the Missing Children Division, City Police. What kind of sick society needs an entire section of its police department dedicated to missing children? He and I walk through the final moments. I stand exactly where I was standing when Starcher left for the restroom, less than 100 feet away. I kept my eyes on him until he went inside. Then I was jolted by the sound of gunfire. Step by step, thought by thought, we go through it all. The men's restroom has only one door and no windows. It is inconceivable to me and to Detective Colfax that someone could grab an 8-year-old boy and physically remove him from the premises without being seen. But at that moment, most of the people hanging around the landing were either crouching behind benches or shrubs or flat on the ground as the bullets were fired. Other witnesses verify this. We estimate the diversion lasted 15, maybe 20 seconds. Plenty of time, I guess. After an hour, I finally admit that Starcher has not simply wandered away. He has been taken. Chapter 17. The best way to tell Judith is to make her see for herself. If something bad happens to our son, she will never forgive me, and she will always maintain that since I am such a lousy parent, am in fact thoroughly derelict in all areas of parental guidance, that his disappearance was and is completely my fault. Great, Judith. You win. I'm to blame. It might help her to see the crime scene, especially with all the cops around. I stare at my cell phone for a long time, then make the call. She answers with, "What is it?" I swallow hard and try to sound calm. "Judith, Starcher has disappeared. I'm at the landing in City Park with his grandmother and with the police. He disappeared about an hour ago. You need to get down here now." She yells,
"What?"
"You heard me. Starcher is missing. I think he's been abducted." Again she yells,
"What? How? Were you watching him?"
"Yes, as a matter of fact, I was. We'll argue later. Just get down here." 21 minutes later, I see her racing along the sidewalk, obviously a woman who's scared out of her mind. As she approaches the landing and sees all the policemen, then me, then the yellow crime scene ribbon strung around the restrooms, she stops, throws a hand over her mouth, and breaks down. Lynn Colfax and I walk over to her and try to calm her. She grits her teeth and says,
"What happened?"
She wipes her eyes as we go through it again, and again. She says nothing to me, as if I am not a part of the drama. She won't even look at me. She grills Colfax until all questions have been asked. She takes complete charge of the family's side of things, even informs the detective that she is the custodial parent, and all communication will be through her. Me? I'm viewed as nothing more than a negligent babysitter. Judith has a photo of Starcher on her cell phone. Colfax emails this to his office. He says that posters will go up immediately. All alerts and warnings are already in play. Every policeman in the city is looking for Starcher. Chapter 18. We eventually leave the landing, though it is painful. I would prefer to sit here all afternoon and throughout the night, just waiting for my little boy to appear and ask, "Where's my boat?" It is the last place he saw his father. If he's just lost, then maybe he'll find his way back. We're sleepwalking through this, numb and stunned, and telling ourselves that this is not really happening. Lynn Colfax says he's been through this before, and the best move right now is for us to meet at Central, in his office, and talk about how to proceed. It's either an abduction, a disappearance, or a kidnapping, and all three pose different problems. I take my mother to my apartment, where she is met by partner. He'll take care of her for a few hours. She's blaming herself for not being more attentive, and she's griping because that bitch Judith wouldn't even acknowledge her presence.
"Why did you ever marry that woman?" she asks.
"It wasn't by choice."
"Really, Mom? Can't we discuss this later?"
Colfax has a neat desk and a calm, soothing presence. It means nothing to us, Judith and me. Ava, the third parent, is out of town. He begins by telling us a story about an abduction, one of the few with a happy ending. Most end badly, and I know this. I've read the summaries. With each passing hour, the chances of a good outcome get slimmer and slimmer. He asks if there is anyone that we know of who might be a suspect. A relative, a neighbor, the pervert down the street, anyone. We shake our heads no. I've already thought about Link Scanlon, and I'm not ready to bring him into this. A kidnapping does not fit his profile. All he wants from me is $100,000 in cash, a refund, and I cannot believe he would resort to kidnapping my son for ransom. Link would prefer to break my right leg this week and my left leg the next. Colfax says it's useful to immediately promise a reward for information. He says a good starting point is $50,000. Judith, the sole parent, says,
"I can handle that."
I doubt if she could stroke a check for that amount, but go, girl. "I'll split it," I say, as if we're playing cards. To make an unbearable situation even worse, Judith's parents arrive and are escorted into the office. They grab their daughter, and all three have a long cry. I stand against a wall, as far away as possible. They do not acknowledge my presence. Starcher lives with these grandparents about half the time, so they are very attached to him.
I try to understand their grief, but I have loathed these people for so long I cannot stand the sight of them. When they settle down, they ask what happened, and I tell them. Colfax helps me out with a few facts here and there. By the time we get through with the narrative, they are convinced everything was all my fault. Great. Now we're getting somewhere. I do not have to stay in the room. I excuse myself, leave the building, and return to the landing. The police are still there, loitering around the boathouse, keeping people away from the men's restroom. I speak to them and express my gratitude. They are sympathetic. Partner arrives, says my mother has had two martinis and is somewhat subdued. He and I split up and roam the walkways of the park. The sun is setting. The shadows are getting longer. Partner brings me a flashlight, and we continue our search well into the night. At 8 p.m., I call Judith to see how she's holding up. She's at home with her parents, waiting by the phone. I offer to come over and sit, but she says no thanks. She has friends over, and I wouldn't fit. I'm sure she's right about that. I roam through the park for hours, shining my light at every bridge, culvert, tree, and pile of rocks. This is the worst day of my life, and when it ends, I sit on a bench at midnight and finally weep. Chapter 19. Aided by whiskey and a pill, I managed to sleep for 3 hours on the sofa before waking in a pool of sweat. Wide awake now, and the nightmare only continues. I shower to kill time and check on my mother. She's had some pills and seems to be in a coma. At dawn, partner and I return to the park. There's nowhere else to go, really. What else am I supposed to do? Sit by the phone? It's in my pocket, and it buzzes at 7:03. Lynn Colfax checks in to see how I'm doing. I tell him I'm at the park, still searching. He says they've had a few tips, but nothing useful. Just some crackpots interested in the reward money. He asks if I've seen the Sunday morning newspaper. Yes, I have. Front page. Partner brings some muffins and coffee, and we eat on a picnic table overlooking a pond that's used for skating in the winter. He asks,
"Have you thought about Link?"
"Yes, I have. But I don't think it's him."
"Why not?"
"Not his kind of crime."
"You're probably right."
We return to the silence that defines our relationship, a quiet I have always appreciated. Now, though, I need someone to talk to. We finish eating and split up again. I cover the same paths and trails, look under the same footbridges, walk along the same creeks. I call Judith mid-morning, and her mother answers her cell phone. Judith is resting, and no, they've heard nothing. Back at the landing, the police have removed the crime scene tape, and things have returned to normal. The place is bustling with people again, all apparently oblivious to yesterday's horror. I watch some boys race their boats around the pond. I stand where I stood yesterday when I saw Starcher for the last time. A dull pain rips through my gut, and I'm forced to walk away. At the rate I'm going, Starcher is the only child I'll ever produce. He was an accident, an unwanted child born in the midst of a raging war between his parents. But in spite of that, he has blossomed into a beautiful boy. I haven't been much of a father, but then I've been shut out of his life. I never dreamed I could miss another human so much. But then, what parent can imagine a child being abducted? Hours pass as I roam the park. I jump out of my skin when my phone rings, but it's only an acquaintance wanting to help. Late in the day, I sit on a park bench near a jogging trail. From out of nowhere, Detective Landy Reardon appears and sits beside me. He's wearing a suit under the standard black trench coat. "What brings you here?" I ask, startled.
"I'm just the messenger, Rudd. Nothing more. Not involved, really. But your kid is okay."
I take a deep breath and lean forward, elbows on knees, thoroughly confused. I manage to grunt, "What?" He stares straight ahead as if I'm not here.
"Your kid's okay. What they want is an exchange."
"An exchange?"
"You got it. You tell me, I tell them. You tell me where the girl is buried, you get your kid back after they find her."
I don't know what to think or say. Praise God, my kid is safe, but he's safe because the cops have snatched him and are holding him as bait. I tell myself I should be angry, furious, volcanic, but I am nothing but relieved. Starcher is okay.
They? Them? You're talking about some of your own people, right?
Sort of. Look, Rudd, you gotta understand that Roy Kemp is pretty much checked out. They've put him on administrative leave for a month or so, but no one knows it. He's a mess, and he's out there acting on his own.
But he has a lot of friends, right?
Oh, yes. Kemp is highly regarded. He's a 30-year man, you know, with a lot of contacts, a lot of pull.
So this is an inside job?
I don't believe it.
And they've sent you to negotiate?
I don't know where the kid is, I swear. And I don't like being where I am right now.
That makes two of us. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. In fact, I should have known the cops were not above snatching kids.
Back off, Rudd. You got a big mouth, you know that?
Deal or no deal?
I'm supposed to tell you what Arch Swanger told me about the girl, right? Where she's buried.
And let's say Swanger is telling the truth. You find the body, he gets busted for capital murder, and my career as a lawyer is over. My son has returned safely to his mother, and I get to spend a lot more time with him. In fact, I'll be a full-time dad.
You're on the right track.
And if I say no, what will happen to my kid? Am I supposed to believe that an assistant chief of police and his thugs will actually hurt a child as revenge?
I guess you gotta roll the dice, Rudd.
Part 5. U-Haul Law. Chapter 1.
I fight the panic. I tell myself my son is safe, and I believe this. But the situation is so urgent that it is impossible to think rationally. Partner and I go to a coffee joint where we huddle in a corner. I walk through the various scenarios as he listens. There is really no choice. The only important thing here is the safety and deliverance of my son. Everything else fades in comparison. If I divulge the secret and lose my license to practice law, I'll survive. Hell, I might even prosper somewhere else, and I certainly won't be dealing with the likes of Arch Swanger again. This could be my ticket out of the profession, my one beautiful opportunity to walk away from the law and to search for real happiness. I want that little boy in my arms. Partner and I debate whether I should call Judith and bring her up to date. I decide not to. Not now, anyway. She will add nothing but stress and complications. And, much more important, she might let it slip to someone else that Kemp and associates have pulled an inside job. Reardon warned me to keep it quiet. I call Judith anyway, just to check on her. Ava answers the phone and says Judith is in bed, medicated, and not doing well. The FBI just left the house. There is a swarm of reporters out in the street. Things are just awful. As if I don't know. At 7 p.m. Sunday, I call Reardon and say we have a deal. It takes an hour to get a search warrant. Obviously, the police have a friendly judge on standby. At 8:30, partner and I leave the city with one unmarked car in front of us and one behind, which is nothing unusual. By the time we get to Dr. Wu's sign, the police are there in force. Spotlights, two backhoes, at least 2 dozen men with shovels and sticks, and a canine squad of dogs in crates. I've told them everything I know, and they're examining the ground next to the rows of corn. State troopers guard the shoulder of the interstate, waving off any driver who might get curious. Partner parks the van where they tell us to park, 100 feet away from the sign and the action.
We sit and watch and hope as the first few frantic moments slip away and the long hours begin. They methodically poke into every square inch of soil. They make a grid, comb through it, then make another one. The backhoes are not used. The dogs stay calm. On the other side of the sign, there are several unmarked black cars bunched together in the darkness. I'm sure Assistant Chief Kemp is waiting in one of them. I loathe him, and would like to personally drill him between the eyes. But right now, he's the man who can deliver my son. And then I remember what he's been through. The horror, the fear, the waiting, the final resignation when he and his wife realized Giuliana was not coming home. Now he's sitting over there praying his men will find some bones, something for him to bury properly. That's the best he can expect. A skeleton. My expectations are far greater, and certainly more realistic. By midnight, I'm cursing Arch Swanger. Chapter 2. As they work through the night, Partner and I take turns nodding off. We're starving and desperate for coffee, but we're not about to leave. At 5:20, Reardon calls my cell and says,
"It's a dry run, Rudd. There's nothing here."
"I've told you everything I know. I swear."
"I believe you."
"Thank you."
"You can leave now. Get back on the interstate, head south to the Four Corners exit. I'll call you back in 20 minutes.
As we pull away, the searchers are packing up their gear. The dogs are still in their crates, resting. Arch Swanger is probably watching and laughing. We head south, and 20 minutes later, Reardon calls again. He says,
"You know that truck stop at Four Corners?"
"I think so."
"Park at the gas pumps, but don't buy any gas. Walk inside. The restaurant is on the right, and at the far end, away from the counter, is a row of booths. Your kid will be there, eating ice cream."
"Got it." I want so badly to say something as stupid as, "Thanks." Like I owe someone a debt of gratitude for kidnapping my child, not hurting him, and then giving him back. Truthfully, though, I am overcome with relief, joy, gratitude, anticipation, and a strange disbelief that this abduction just might end on a happy note. This never happens. A minute later, my phone buzzes again. It's Reardon, and he says,
"Look, Rudd, there's nothing to be gained by pursuing this matter. Asking a bunch of questions, running to the press, chasing cameras, you know, your typical routine. We'll take care of the press and leak it that you pulled off a dramatic rescue after an anonymous phone call. Our kidnapping investigation will continue, but we'll turn up nothing. Are we on the same page here, Rudd?"
"Yes, I'm with you." I'll agree to anything at this point.
"The story is that someone snatched your kid, got fed up with the brat because he probably acts a lot like you, and decided to ditch him at a truck stop. You got the story, Rudd?"
"Got it," I manage to spit out as I bite my tongue to keep from unloading every vile word in the book. The truck stop is awash with lights and crowded with rigs stacked in neat rows. We park by the pumps, and I walk quickly inside. Partner stays in the van to watch for anyone who might be watching us. The restaurant is busy with the breakfast crowd. The smell of thick grease hangs in the air. The counter is lined with beefy truckers devouring pancakes and sausages. I turn a corner, see the booths, pass one, two, three, and there in the fourth booth, all alone, is little Starcher Whitley, grinning from behind a large bowl of chocolate ice cream. I kiss him on top of his head, tousle his hair, and sit across from him. "Are you okay?" I ask. He shrugs and says,
"Sure, I guess."
"Did anyone hurt you?" He shakes his head. "No." "Tell me, Starcher, did anyone do anything to hurt you?"
"No. They were very nice."
"And who is they? Who has been with you since you left the park on Saturday?"
"Nancy and Joe."
A waitress stops at the booth. I order some coffee and scrambled eggs. I ask her,
Who brought this kid in here?
The waitress looks around, says,
I don't know. Some woman was here just a minute ago, said the kid wanted a bowl of ice cream. She must have left or something. I guess you're paying for the ice cream.
Gladly. Do you have surveillance cameras? She nods at the window.
Out there, but not in here. Something the matter?
No, thanks. As soon as she leaves, I ask Starcher, Who brought you in here?
Nancy.
He takes a bite of ice cream. Look, Starcher, I want you to put the spoon down for a moment, and I want you to tell me what happened when you went into the restroom at the park. You were racing your boat, you had to pee, and you walked to the restroom. Now, tell me what happened. He slowly sticks the spoon into the ice cream and leaves it there.
Well, all of a sudden, this big man grabbed me. I thought he was a policeman because he was wearing a uniform.
Did he have a gun?
I don't think so. He put me in a truck that was right behind the restroom. There was another man driving the truck, and they drove away real fast. They said they were taking me to the hospital because something bad had happened to my grandmother. They said you would be at the hospital. So we drove and drove, and then we were out of the city, way out in the country, and that's where they left me with Nancy and Joe. The men left, and Nancy said my grandmother was going to be okay, and that you would stop by real soon to get me.
Okay. That was Saturday morning. What did you do the rest of Saturday, and all day yesterday, Sunday?
Well, we watched television, some old movies and stuff, and we played backgammon a lot.
Backgammon?
Uh-huh. Nancy asked me what games I liked to play, and I said backgammon. They didn't know what it was, so Joe went to the store and bought a backgammon board, a cheap one. I taught them how to play, and beat them, too.
So they were nice to you?
Real nice. They kept telling me you were at the hospital and couldn't leave.
Partner finally comes inside. He is relieved to see Starcher, and gives the kid a pat on the head. I tell him to find the manager of the truck stop and locate the surveillance cameras. Inform the manager that the FBI will want the footage, so take care of it. My eggs arrive, and I ask Starcher if he's hungry. No, he's not. He's been eating pizza and ice cream for the past 2 days. Anything he wanted. Chapter 3. Since I've never been invited into Starcher's home, I decide that I will not take him there. I don't want the drama and theatrics. Half an hour from the city, I finally call Judith with the news that her son is safe. He's sitting on my lap as we ride up the interstate. She is almost too stunned to speak, so I give Starcher my phone. He says, Hi, Mom, and I think she has a complete meltdown. I give them a few minutes, then take the phone back and explain that I got a call and was instructed to pick him up at the truck stop. No, he had not been harmed in any way, except maybe too much sugar. The parking lot outside her office is still empty. It's only 7:30, and we wait in peace before the storm. The black Jaguar slides into the lot and brakes hard next to the van. I step out with Starcher as Judith gets out and lunges for the kid. She grabs him, bawling and clawing, and right behind are her parents and Ava. They take turns squeezing the kid. Everybody's crying. I can't stand these people, so I walk over to Starcher, tousle his hair again, and say, I'll see you later, bud. He's being smothered and doesn't respond. I ask Judith to step aside for a moment, and when we're alone, I say, Can we meet here with the FBI later in the morning? There's more to the story.
Tell me now, she hisses.
I'll tell you when I want to tell you, and that's with the FBI listening, okay? She hates it when she's not in control. She takes a deep breath, grits her teeth, and manages to say, Sure. I walk away, refuse to acknowledge her parents, and get in the van. As we drive away, I look at Starcher and wonder when I'll see him again. Chapter 4. At 9 a.m., I'm in court for a preliminary hearing. By then, the news is out, courtesy of a leak by the police, that my son has been found and returned to his parents. The judge grants me a continuance, and I hurry out of the courtroom. I have a handful of lawyer pals, and several of them want to chat and offer congratulations. I'm just not in the mood. Fango ambushes me in the hallway, just like he did 3 weeks ago. I keep walking and refuse to look at him. He falls in beside me and says,
"Say, Rudd, Link is getting pretty anxious about the money. I told him about your kid and all, and by the way, he sends his concerns."
"Tell Link to worry about his own problems," I snap, as we march stride for stride.
"He is, and one of his problems just happens to be you and the money."
"Too bad," I say, and walk even faster. He labors to keep up with me, labors to think of something clever to say, and makes a big mistake with,
"You know, your kid just might not be that safe after all."
I wheel around and throw a tight right cross that lands perfectly on his chin. He walks into it and doesn't see it until it's too late. His head jerks so violently that I hear the crunching of bones somewhere, and in the first split second I think I've broken his neck. But his neck is fine. He's been hit before, plenty of times, and has the scars to prove it. Fango sprawls across the marble floor, and when he finally comes to rest, he doesn't move. Out cold. A perfect knockout punch that I could never replicate. I'm tempted to kick him in the head a few times for good measure, but out of the corner of my eye I see a sudden movement. Another thug is moving toward me, and he's reaching for a pocket and a weapon. Someone yells behind me. The second thug goes down as hard as Fango when partner whacks him over the head with a stainless steel baton he carries in his coat pocket. The baton is designed for just such occasions. When contracted, it's about 6 inches long, but when whipped out properly, it extends to 18 inches and is equipped with a steel knob at its tip. It can easily crack a skull, is in fact designed to do so. I tell partner to give it to me and disappear. A security guard runs over and looks at the two unconscious thugs. I hand him my Bar Association ID card and say, "Sebastian Rudd, attorney at law. These two goons just tried to jump me." A crowd gathers. Fango wakes up first, mumbling and rubbing his jaw. Then he tries to stand, but can't find his feet. Finally, with the help of the security guard, he gets up, still wobbly, and wants to leave. A cop makes him sit on a nearby bench while an EMT tends to his buddy. Eventually, the second guy wakes up with a very large knot on the back of his head. They ice it for a few minutes, then put him on the same bench with Fango. I stand close and glare at them. They glare right back. The EMT gives me an ice pack for my right hand. Getting punched is nothing for these two, and they're not about to press charges. That would require paperwork, a lot of questions, and no small amount of prying by the police. They work for Link Scanlon, and they don't answer questions. Right now, they can't wait to get out of the building and back on the streets, where they make the rules. I tell the police that I, too, have no desire to press charges. As I walk away, I lean close to Fango and whisper, "Tell Link that if I hear one more word out of you or him, I'm going to the FBI. Fango sneers as if he might spit in my face. Chapter 5. I suppose some days are meant to be spent with the FBI. I walk into the lobby of Judith's firm a few minutes after 11 a.m. The receptionist is smiling and chatting with a paralegal. They smile at me and gush with congratulations. I don't realize it immediately, but they think I'm some sort of hero. A lawyer sticks her head out of her office door and says congratulations. The mood is almost jubilant. And why not? Starcher has been rescued and is safely at home, where he belongs. We were all numb, shell-shocked, terrified, and waiting for the nightmare to become a tragedy. Instead, we got lucky. Judith is in a large, well-appointed conference room with two FBI agents, Beatty and Agnew. Though my right hand is swollen and throbbing, I manage to shake their hands without any evidence of pain. I nod at Judith, say no to coffee, and ask how Starcher is doing. Just fine. Everything is swell. Beatty, the talker, explains that Judith called the FBI late Saturday afternoon, but they had not officially entered the investigation. Agnew, the note-taker, scribbles away and nods his head. Whatever Beatty says is exactly true. The FBI does not get involved in kidnappings until the local police invite them in, or there is evidence that the victim has been moved across state lines. He prattles on for a while, smug with his importance. I let him go. "Now," Beatty says, looking at me, "you wanted to meet?" "Yes," I reply. "I know exactly who kidnapped Starcher, and I know why." Agnew's pen stops in mid-stroke, as everyone freezes. With her eyebrows arched, Judith says, "Do tell." So I tell the story. All of it. Chapter 6. The elation Judith felt upon our son's return dissipates halfway through my narrative. When it becomes apparent that the abduction was a direct result of another one of my notorious cases, her body language shifts dramatically, and her mind starts racing away. Now, finally, she has clear proof that I am a danger to Starcher. She'll probably file papers this afternoon. I avoid eye contact with her, but the vibes are strong enough to spike the tension in the room. When I finish, Beatty seems stunned. Agnew has burned through an entire legal pad with his chicken scratch. Beatty says,